Hi, everyone. This is another episode of The Three Questions with Andy Richter, which is me. And my special guest tonight is someone that I have known for a very long time, is practically family to me at this point. And it's Mike Sweeney, who is a longtime head writer on the Conan show. Now, what is your title now, by the way?
Yeah, what is it? I guess writer, producer.
Yeah. Well, tell people tell people what the difference is between what you used to do and what you do now.
Now is much better.
Yes.
Let's just the bad thing has gone away. I was head writer for 15 years, which I think is a sign of mental illness on my part.
Yeah.
I don't think you're supposed to be the head writer of a late night show that long.
It is a sense. But, it's a sense of it's a indication of competence, of skill, of people skills, and also something really, really wrong with you.
Very, very wrong. And that should be really at the top.
The kind of codependence that you only find in someone who has made the choice to become someone's sidekick for the rest of their life. That's another kind of sickness.
Yeah, but you took a big break there.
I did. I took some time off and came crawling back.
You seem much more
mature. Came crawling back.
so much wiser and more mature the second time around.
Well, now, but it did. It got crazy because you were having to, when Conan started doing a lot of these remote kind of specials.
Right. And then, you mean like weekly?
Yeah.
You mean like shows in different cities?
No, I mean like going to Armenia, you know?
Oh, the travel.
Yeah, the travel shows.
Right.
But also too, every time he had an extracurricular thing, like
giving
out awards at the Kennedy Center Honors or something,
you kind of
had to accompany him on that stuff.
Yeah, I would like the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2013 as kind of wrangling that. And but the travel, yes, going to being in Armenia, I remember that because all the writers were still working and they were writing beats for things. And so I'd like, it'd be 10 a.m. in Armenia and I'd be like, it'd be 11 at night and I'd be like, oh, everyone's showing up at work now, so I've got to make sure I've gone through all their pitches and pick things. And it was crazy to do both jobs.
I remember, because the only one I've ever been on is Berlin. And I think we were flying back from Berlin after having shot a whole remote. And you were on the plane having to get ready. And it was, it was like Sunday. And you're having to sit there and get ready, Monday show ready on the plane ride back from Germany.
Yeah, yes.
And that was
problematic. But you know what? I had that muscle built up where there's always another show coming.
Yeah.
So I was just like, okay, the plane ride home is when I'll figure that out. Mm. And you just have, that was the hardest adjustment was there's a show every day at tapes at 5:30. Something has to happen at 5:30.
Yeah.
And because I'm man, from school age on, I was a terrible procrastinator.
Yeah.
And that kind of beat it out of you.
Yeah, I can only get things done if someone else has set a deadline for me.
That's how I am.
Yeah. Like
I am the same way. Like I will work really hard, but someone has to tell me to work really hard.
Yeah.
If I'm in charge, it's really bad.
I still at this age I think I've got to change that, but I don't know if I'm capable of it. I mean, I do, as time has gone on, I've gotten sort of more, because I've had to be in some way, like more self-directed, but I don't know whether I should just go with it.
Just go with it.
Or keep trying to fix it.
I am this has been my agony for years and years. And my therapist, I just feel so bad. I should just cut him loose because it's like the same old, I want to be doing more. But then when I'm left to my own devices. I don't do anything.
Oh, my and God. Can you make a tape so I can play it for my therapist so he can just hear it in a different voice?
Why don't we switch therapists?
They would never know.
For a while. It'll probably be the exact same.
Yeah, exactly.
He'll be like, Andy, please, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's bad. It's bad. Yeah, I at the exact same crossroads, just lean in to being a lazy piece of shit and just go with it.
Well, I prefer to think of it as other directed, like I'm directed by others. Like I'm such a fucking empath and I'm so devoted to my fellow man that's why I'm a lazy slob, because I'm just waiting for someone to give me the permission to reach my full potential.
All your energy is going to other people.
Yeah.
And you're not saving that time for yourself.
How did that happen that you switched from being the day-to-day head writer to then Matt O'Brien came in to do the day-to-day show? And you're sort of left to do more sort of, you're like an emeritus now. You do the travel shows and very funny written bits. You'll come in every now and then.
Once in a while.
Yeah.
Yes. When someone tells me to do it. And, you know what? It was like 2015. I was just like, I can't just keep doing this head writer job. It's just crazy. You know what it was? We did a week of shows at Comic-Con, and every time we ever, you know, like we do a week of shows in Chicago, we do a week of shows in New York, we do a week of shows in San Francisco. The crowd, I mean, you know what it's like. There's like 3,000 people in the audience. They go insane. When you walk out right before the show starts, there's a roar. You think the roof's going to fall in. And then the show starts, it's insanity. And the first night of those weekly shows, I would always get a tingle up my spine. And I remember at Comic-Con, we had all this great comedy. The rehearsals went very well. The crowd was going insane, and I it's the first time I didn't have the old excitement.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I remember that. I was like, oh, this isn't ideal. You know, that crazy tingling excitement was gone. So I thought,
was that the first Comic-Con that we did?
Yeah. That was like in 2015. Yeah. I think.
Cause we've done.
Yeah.
Haven't we done like four of them?
Four or five.
Yeah.
I think.
Four or five. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just kind of dwelt on that for a while. And also it was really hard. He wanted to be doing more travel shows. And I was like, well, it's really hard to do that and the head writer job, because it's very time. So I just went to Conan and proposed, what if I stopped being head writer and just worked on the travel shows and any outside stuff you're doing? Like he hosted do you remember when he hosted the Nobel Peace Prize concert?
Yes.
In Oslo.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was a ton of work though, but it was also one of my favorite things ever, because we were at the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony. It was him, me, Jason Shalemi, our field producer, and like, you know, our camera guys and Jason Munoz, our sound man. And we were just like, we thought we were going to get arrested and tossed out of there. And then he had to host a show for like 8,000 Norwegians in this cavernous arena. It was crazy.
When you think Nobel Peace Prize concert, you go right to Conan O'Brien. He's got to be there.
Yeah. You know? You know what? I think they stopped doing the concert the year after we did it.
Who were the bands? Was it like bands of like physicists that all, have a Beach Boys cover band?
Sting was there. I remember Sting was there.
He's fun. And he's like a really good sport. He's done a lot of stuff with us.
He loves comedy. And I learned a lot about the Nobel Prize. I didn't realize the Peace Prize was only in Norway. And the other ones are all in Stockholm, Sweden. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. And I wonder why.
For some reason, they decided to throw a bone to Norway. Oh. I don't know why. So they're like, we'll give you the Peace Prize.
Yeah.
So they have this building that's made just to pick the Peace Prize winner once a year. But there's a whole giant building. The whole thing's a sham.
They got to be able to rent that out for weddings and stuff, though.
That's a great idea.
You know, I mean, come on. You can't have that all the way around.
Yeah. No, it's a giant waste of space. Anyway.
Well, I was happy that you did that. Not just for you. I mean, I miss you in the day-to-day running of the show because it's really gone downhill.
Yeah, it's been
deeply. I was happy that happened because I know, like I say, on a plane with you, riding back on a first class Lufthansa flight, which is ridiculous, and then you're there working, and I felt like, oh my god,
what a waste of first class.
Mike's got a shitty life. Oh.
You know, that Berlin show is and other people have said it's the funniest. I think it's the funniest travel show. There's Conan with the dominatrix, which is hilarious. And then the scene you did with Conan where you took a shoe plotler dance.
Yeah, the lesson. Slapping dance.
Right. And you and Conan are in lederhosen. And they're being, you two are being, well, everyone had been drinking.
Yes.
An hour, which was helped make it extra fun.
Well, we were literally in the Hofbräu. We were literally in in the Hofbräu, and the place is pretty much closed, but the people working there are like, you want some beer? Like to all of us, like, oh yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, you got
it's what we do. Yeah. All we do is serve beer. Yeah, yeah. Let us do what we do for you. And then you guys got a lesson from two twins, or they were brothers?
They were brothers and their dad.
We didn't know that the musician who was playing with him was their dad.
Yeah.
And like I hired this musician. They said, oh, they've got a guy. And then the guy turned out to be their dad, and he was kind of, you know, it just became as you two both zeroed in on the sordid family relationship.
Yeah.
Of this father playing accordion and his two sons slapping each other's ass for money.
Yeah, it was a fun thing. And that dad guy was wonderfully unimpressed with any of our shenanigans. And also, like,
he was a great straight
man. Yeah. And he was like, hey, you got to do, you know, if you're going to do this shoe slapping folk dance, you got to do it right. You know, like,
right.
It's like,
he was all business, which was exactly what you want. He was the perfect. Who would think a German would be a good straight man?
Yeah. A German who's celebrating small town culture, small town German culture.
So I'm glad I'm not doing that anymore. Matt O'Brien's doing a great job. And you know what? I like when I watch rehearsal now, it's like, oh my God. Because that used to be me in the hot seat.
Yeah.
Next to Conan, who's between you and Conan. You're super sharp. He's crazily sharp. And, you know, all the comedy bits kind of have to, you know, you and Conan are usually seeing them for the first time.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have to pass muster with you guys. And it's brutal. There's so many times I was really confident about stuff. I'm like, they're going to love this. It would just blow. It would just get zero laughs in rehearsal, and it kind of cracked me up because it's like, of course,
yeah,
of course,
yeah.
And you know, it'd be like, what are we gonna do on the show today?
Yeah, no, that was for my evolution, you know. I mean, because I had acted before, but I had never really done well, and I had worked on a pilot for a TV show.
Are you talking about before you started?
Before I started on Late Night. But that process of figuring out the comedy and being, well, in a way, being brutal about it. Like, just being like, no, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. And realizing early on, like, that's the way it has to kind of be. Because you don't have any time. If you want it to be good. And you don't have any time to be to assuage feelings. It's like, no, this is, well, we got to make this work. It needs a new ending, you know, and then we got to think of an ending. And going from that out here to LA, when I came out here to do sitcoms,
right,
I realized very quickly that when somebody makes a pitch and it's not really good, they'll be like, well, that's a really good idea, but I think we can maybe do it. Where I was just like, nope, that's not funny. And people were like, what a dick. But I mean,
oh my God.
But I was like,
who's this horror?
Well, and then there also too is the sitcom, the sitcom fake laughter that happens.
Oh my God.
At rehearsals and stuff where, you know, like for every joke, the writers are like, ha 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 ha.
Oh my God.
Go ahead.
The first time I'd ever encountered that was at Late Night. And it was in my office, and someone put a tape in the outer room, and I've never heard laughter like this, the most explosive laughter. And it was a table read for a sitcom.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fake.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is fake, right? And they're like, no, all the writers laugh. But it was such fake.
It's, yeah.
Who falls for that?
They all do, and then if you don't, you're a dick. Like I would.
Oh my God!
I wouldn't laugh at things.
I could see that.
And writers would sort of, after a while, come up to me like, "Wow, you're really tough to make laugh." And I'm like, "No, I'm not. No, I'm not." You know, and I mean, and then there's other things too where I think writers would, they give you something and you read it and you go like, "Oh, that's really funny," but you know, because.
Well, that's common.
Yeah, it's like
people going, "Oh, yeah, that'll work.
That's great,
that'll work."
Oh, that's great. Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
And I always think it's like, I don't know what out here, it just seemed
out
like
here in LA.
Yeah, out here in LA, it just seemed like people. It's like magicians going, "Ooh, ah," like to each other's magic tricks. It's like we know
they never catch on.
It's a gimmick. Relax.
To where the bunny is.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, they're the ones who wrote the magic trick.
I know.
It's so self-serving. It's like, that's fantastic.
I know. I was on Just Shoot Me when Marsh McCall, who was a head writer on the Conan show, was a head writer there. And I got I did a guest spot on that. And I was sitting. There was like one of the run throughs, you know, like it was, we had done the table read and this was, and then you rehearse all day and then they were going to do a run through for the writers. And it was after lunch and Brian Posehn and I were sitting backstage, like behind the set, kind of in semi darkness, just like reading or sitting there, kind of chilling out, waiting for our time. And I heard them all on the other side of the flat come in and start the rehearsal. And it was a scene with George Segal and David Spade. And they start, you know, and you hear the kind of, you hear the dialogue start. And then the first laugh line comes and the loud burst of laughter actually startled me because it was like the fifth time, that we'd all heard this fucking joke. And they're all like, ah, ha, 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 ha. It's like, oh man.
That's exactly what the laughter sounds like too.
And the thing that kills me is how do you know? How do you know when there's a wolf if everyone's saying wolf all the time?
Yes.
You know? It just...
Well, I never understood with sitcoms where, you know, they do a scene several times and they kind of tell the audience, hey, you got to pretend you didn't hear it. It's like, what? No, that's not...
But
it's... To me, I would just be like, oh, well, let's come up with something else. But, you know, it's just kind of, they ram it into the ground.
Yeah. Well, and I did find... doing multi-camera sitcoms out here that the audience really wants to help. Like they're just there to help. So they will laugh every time as you know, but that's different. That's like, you're asking the townsfolk to help us do this barn raising and the barn is a sitcom, but it's, you know, but I mean, it's like, we shouldn't be laughing at it, but
no.
Yeah.
And that's like going back to the late night thing. It literally, like there was no time. You're right. There was no time. And that was like when something went great, there was no time to kind of like, oh, look what I did. And that kind of like, there was no glory lap. But on the other hand, when things bombed, like you wrote something and it bombed in rehearsal, you were also very grateful to move on quickly.
Yes.
And like, you know, there wasn't time to dwell on that.
No. As Tommy Blatcher, who's one of the writers on the show, said, you said you pitch it once. If somebody says no, let it go. Unless you really think that it's really great, then pitch it a second time. And if it gets turned down a second time, then let it go. And that is
a very good rule.
Yeah.
Do not. I know people will pitch the same thing. And it's like, what do you do? Everyone remembers the first time you did it.
Yeah.
And no one went for
right.
it. And you're not helped. It's just you start looking.
There are some writers that I've come across who part of their component of their sort of, you know, makeup in writing comedy is that there should be some justice. You know, like, wait, this is the best joke. And everyone's like, I'm sorry. It isn't, you know? And
that's one of my favorite things.
Yeah.
I'll never forget, because I was doing stand up at the time when everyone was, you know, it's like, who's going to replace Letterman? Who's going to replace Letterman? And I was, you know, working at clubs in New York and stuff. And we're out one night after, you know, you'd go out to a diner every night and it's like 2 a.m. and I guess they had flown all these comedians to LA to audition for Lorne Michaels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a week later and it's like, who's it going to be? And we found out that night it was a guy named Conan O'Brien, not a stand up. He was a writer. And all the comedians were outraged.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't go through the clubs. And I was just like, ha ha. It's not a law firm. You're not making partner.
Right, right.
It's show business and people, anything can happen. Like that to me is the first thing you learn is there's no fairness. Mm-mm. There's no, or your perception of what should be fair. Throw that out the window day one.
Yeah.
And just enjoy the good with the bad. Cause it's all going to be insane.
Yeah.
And I remember I'd never heard of him and I was just delighted that a non-comic got the job.
Yeah.
And they were outraged. And you know what? I've dealt with writers on shows, exactly what you're saying, who the same way, like they would be mad if a joke that they thought was great didn't get on.
Yeah.
And then they'd come to me as head writer and go, can you laugh harder at this joke? And I was like, no.
Oh, boy.
Like when we read it in front of Conan, I'm like, no.
Wow.
I'm not going to do that.
I can't wait till we're off podcast and I can ask you exactly who it was because I had some guesses.
Sure.
Well, now you're
justice.
You're not a Californian. You're from New Jersey, correct?
I grew up in New Jersey.
Yeah. And you're from a Irish Catholic household, correct?
Well, yeah. I didn't grow up with any sense of being Irish
or Catholic.
Catholic. I was Catholic.
Yeah.
I guess. But not, I never went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
I always went to public school. And so I had to go to Sunday school where I didn't, you know, I paid zero attention. And so, yeah. But it's funny. It's like, as I became an adult, I would notice things and I'd be like, oh, I'm Irish. Like personality traits, you know, like being paranoid
right.
or never forgetting, you know, if someone crosses you like that.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
I'd see this in other people and I'm just like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Or and like abscess.
Possibly drinking.
And abscesses of rage that even you didn't know were there that all of a sudden come out. Like, oh,
yeah.
I hit a pocket here and I'm angry about something.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I just, it was like a very white suburb of New Jersey. And
you,
so it was very generic. Like I thought everyone was Catholic and Jewish. That's the makeup of the neighborhood I grew up in.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd never met a WASP. I think there was a guy who was a Methodist in high school. And I thought he was like a persecuted minority.
a unicorn.
I just thought everyone was Catholic or Jewish.
Yeah.
That was it.
And you have two sisters, right? Is that right?
I have two older sisters.
Yeah.
So I was the baby.
You're the baby. And were you treated as such?
I was totally, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I, like when we finally were going to have a child, I wanted a girl because I felt like raised by women.
Yeah.
Because my father really wasn't around. So it was mostly my mother and my two sisters. And that's what I was used to. And I never had a brother. So I just assumed I always more comfortable around the female gender than the male. But I've told you before, I had a crazy upbringing.
Yes.
I mean, everyone has had a crazy upbringing.
But no, but yours is, I mean, just throw out a few of the details. I mean, I don't,
show enough of my penis to win the longest penis.
What?
The Milton Berle. That old Milton Berle joke. Oh, you've heard that.
Right.
Right?
That's right, right.
Yeah.
Just take out enough to win. Yeah.
Just enough to win.
Yeah, yeah.
My mother had something called dissociative identity, which used to be called multiple personality disorder.
Mm.
They changed the name for some reason. I guess.
Well, isn't it because the multiple personality is kind of like not entirely apt, that it's like, it's not necessarily.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Like, I remember seeing that show, The United States of Tara. Do you remember that show?
Yeah. Or Sybil. Sybil was the first one.
But then United States of Tara tried to make it like the husband, like they started buying outfits for her different characters, mm-hmm. the wife's characters. And I was just like, oh,
that's not how it works.
Yeah. It's no one's hanging around for fun time. There are no fun times.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't know that when we were little. We just knew that, in hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, those were different personalities. But she would just set off on this rage at my father that would always culminate in violence. So you knew it was coming, and she'd start grabbing butcher knives and chasing. You felt like you were in a cartoon, because it was, you know, a house where the dining room's connected to the kitchen, which is connected to the hallway, to the living room, to the dining room, and you'd literally be running around in a circle with her chasing you, and you're like, should I cut back the other way? Or, you know, it was terrible. We were kids, so it was terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she'd turn us against her father, because he was an alcoholic. So she's like, I act this way because your father, the way your father behaves, and, you know, if he would only act normal and stop drinking, I wouldn't act this way.
Mm.
And, you know, we were like, I was 10 years old. She brainwashed us, basically.
Yeah.
My sisters and I, and we all just believed her. And then she'd turn us against him. So then our job was like, if she got mad at him, we'd have to kick him out of the house and wire the doors shut so he couldn't get back in.
Oh my God.
So that, yeah. And then he'd go sleep in a flop house somewhere. And he had a big power. He was the director of research for a pharmaceutical company.
Wow.
And he was the mayor of our town.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's like a part-time job.
Yeah.
It was like a small town. So, you know, he's supposed to supposed to be in like the Memorial Day parade the next day, and he's sleeping out in the car in the driveway because he got kicked out of the house.
Wow.
So.
Well, did the police have to get called from time to time, or?
The police came sometimes.
Because I would have met you like, oh, I got to go out to the mayor's house again, you know?
Yeah, no, it was, but you know, I was brought up that you didn't talk about it. So I never told anyone about any of this stuff till I was, like, I ended up living at home taking care of her till I was 26.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, it was bad.
I mean, I think about, because I lived through, you know, like there was a period of major dysfunction and violence in my childhood. But it was not, you know, it was like within a certain set of amount of time.
Right.
But what I think back on is just... And something that I've thought about, you know, when you hear about kids living in a situation like that, or just in a situation with an unreliable parent who can explode.
Right.
Just the sense of never, never being able to be relaxed, to always,
yes.
always feel uptight going into the place where you're supposed to feel most secure and most safe. And that's gotta, you know, I mean, did you feel that? Or was it like times where you felt, you know, you're living on eggshells because you didn't know when this person might go crazy?
All the time.
Yeah.
All the time. We were all like that. And it was hard to predict what would trigger. It was literally like lighting a fuse, really long fuse. And you knew when it was lit. You could never really predict when it was lit. And then you knew it was just going to build and build. And the tension of the building to when the violence started. I mean, there were times things would erupt and it would be close to bedtime. And then you'd go up and try to go to sleep. And I would literally push furniture against the door so I could sleep, because I knew, like, at 1 a.m. she was going to come up, you know, with a knife, or she'd go to the garage and get like a pitchfork or something. I mean, really dramatic, or an axe. Like, once my sisters and I were locked in the upstairs bathroom and she was chopping, she was doing The Shining. She was chopping through the door, and I was looking out the window, like trying to figure out how badly we'd get hurt if, you know, we had to jump. But, there's one time I finally this is years later. I mean, that's when we were young teens, but like when I was living just with her, and I must have been 23 or 24, and it was starting to really screw with my head. And there was one night where I was just like, you know what? That is it. And I just had it. And I went downstairs to the garage and I got a chainsaw. I came up to the room, the TV room where she's sitting. I started the chainsaw. I was just like screaming, like, you like it? How do you like it? You know, I was like, I'm going to fucking kill you. I'm going to kill you. And she just looked at me and laughed. And I was just like, wow, she's a good supervillain.
Wow.
She's impressive. And it helps me to say it out loud, but I was on the edge of killing her. Wow. And I was very close, and never before or since, obviously, but I turned my chainsaw off and put it downstairs, but I had to pull myself back from it. And that, you know, that it, what it makes me think, like, sometimes I'll hear about teenagers who are in an abusive family and they kill their father-in-law or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it upsets me so much, because from my own experience, I understand that when you're in that nuclear family, you don't know you'll ever be able to just escape from it. It seems so obvious. I mean,
yeah,
looking obviously, but
it seems like there's no way out. Like, it's just, this is it.
When you're in it, yeah, and you're young, and your parents have always been dominating like that, you don't see a way out.
Yeah.
And
well, I think also too, you're living in a perpetual fight or flight state.
Right.
And there's no room for conceptualizing. Like, you can't, in the middle of a fight or flight state, think, what will my life be like in 2 years? You know,
right.
Thinking about now yeah. I'm either going to die or I'm not going to die. Or right. Now, you know, like, just, or, and not even so much die, just the world's right. Going to end. You're going to end everything. Right. And I just don't think that there's any room for you to think in theoretical terms about the future. You just are in the now. And that's,
yeah.
And that's, you're trapped there by these fucking crazy people. Yeah.
Yes. By the way, I want to say I'm really good with a chainsaw, and people need, right. You know, brush cleared, or
sure.
I do the job,
right.
Clean up and leave. They don't have to worry right. about any.
And when it comes to chainsaw, you can be a man of action, not just talk.
Right, right. You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
My mother did call the police on me once around this time, believe it or not. Because I went to law school and I was studying for the bar exam. And my girlfriend called up and my mother got on the phone and started calling her a whore. So I got upset and I kind of yelled at her and threw up against the refrigerator. And she, she grabbed a butcher knife. So I knocked the knife out and pushed her against the refrigerator. And she went into her bedroom and called the cops and said I was trying to kill her. So it was the night before the bar exam, and I had a lot of studying left to do. And
all these police cars
showed up. And I'm just like, oh, gosh, this is going to cut into my study time. Like, I literally was just recalibrating. You know, when am I going to finish studying torts if I have to deal with these cops? And, you know, they all surrounded, like I came out to the front porch. I mean, I knew it was funny. But they all surrounded me. They're like, oh, don't move. You know? And I'm like, okay, let's talk.
Yeah. But they know? I mean, haven't these cops been to this house before and they know?
No, you know what? No one. Like the last time cops were there before that was like when I was 7 or 8. So no, we had all been, we'd been left alone. Like no one in my family reached out to help us. Everyone was terrified.
Your dad gone at this point?
He died when I was 19. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that was crazy too, 'cause he died of emphysema, and the last years of his life, he was on, those giant oxygen tanks. Mm-hmm. And he ended up rooming with me in my room. But because we had been kind of brainwashed against him, I didn't talk to him for the two years we were roommates.
Oh my God.
But I would change his, you know, oxygen tanks for him. But I literally thought he was the enemy and I wasn't allowed to talk to him. Wow. And then when he died, my sisters and I, this is how brainwashed we were. We thought my mother would be fine because he was dead. And so we were excited. We were happy. And, you know, of course, then instead of him being the main focus, we became the main focus of all our craziness. And
was there a revisionist history that he was a saint after he died, that kind of thing? Or was he still a bad person?
By your mom. Oh, no.
Oh, yeah.
No. No, but then she just turned on us and, you know, would, you know, she told us we could never leave. We could never move out. We owed it to her to make her, you know, she's upset, but it's all our fault and we're not doing our responsibilities around the house, blah, blah, blah. And then like, if you, you know, after a night of her being crazy and trying to kill you, like if you, she'd be like, you seem upset today. What's wrong? Because she would be, she'd be a different person.
She'd forget.
She'd be like, what's bothering you? And I was like, well, you chased us around with a knife, you ba 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 da 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 da, and you tell her everything. And she'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like she'd literally say, I don't know what you're talking. And then 2 hours later, she'd be like, you know, I thought about what you said and you just made that stuff up to get out of your responsibilities here. And then she'd build up from there and get crazy again. So you never got a moment. There was zero satisfaction. There was never even like, I'm sorry. You know what? I'm sorry for what it was. You started to wonder whether you were hallucinating or not.
Wow.
It was just crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Now, why? And I mean, and this is something because I've known. I mean, I knew, and you've talked before about these similar incidents, and there are no repeats at this. Like she had new programming all the time, and how do you come out of that as normal as you are? How do you come out of that as kind of an even keeled, like you're a wonder? I mean, from what I can see, you're a wonderful father. You're a wonderful husband. You were great to work with. You're a very much of like, you're just a very even, kind, thoughtful person. And you have every reason in the world to be a monster.
I think when I was little, I was like the peacekeeper in the house. And so, you know, I try to make my mother laugh, you know, that old thing where,
right.
But I think when she wasn't having these episodes, she was a very loving mother. So, you know, I'm telling you the dramatic stuff,
but I know.
When she wasn't like that, she was, I think, a really smart, funny, loving mother. So I think that's why, I felt kind of normal. And my sisters too. I mean, we're super tight now because we went through this together. So.
Yeah.
But
did you all cope with it? Did your sisters cope with it okay?
Yeah,
too?
I think we all did.
That's incredible.
I mean, I never told anyone about this till I was like 24 years old, and I thought I was going to get struck by lightning because it'd been drummed into me. You never talk about what happens in your home, which is another Irish thing.
Yeah.
But you know, then I started going to therapy and that helped. But,
yeah.
And stopped any relationship with my mother. Like, I'd invite her to her wedding and, you know, we just had, cause she was just really bad, you know?
Yeah.
She was, at the time I considered her to be evil. I mean, but you know, obviously it's severe mental illness. But,
yeah. Did you ever get a sense from her that she was aware that she was sick?
No. And years and years later, I guess around 10 years ago, she was living alone. And, you know, I was just, it always ate at me. And I was like, I'm going to get a call that she's been dead for a month. And, you know, cats have broken into the house to eat her and all that stuff. And it's going to end horribly. And I'm going to feel guilty, even though I shouldn't feel guilty. Oh, well, but then she hurt her back in the house and my sisters got her to an emergency room. And while they were treating her back, they were like going to the doc. Cause we used to try to talk her into going to get mental to please, please go see a doctor. And she was like, there's nothing. I don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing wrong with me. You're making all this stuff up. None of this is true. Da, 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 da. It's all you three children are the problem now that your father's dead and blah, 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 blah. So they finally get her to a hospital and she's admitted for her injured back. And they're like, please, I don't know if they tipped them or what they did. They're like, please give her a psychiatric exam. And they locked her up for 2 days and gave her all these tests. And they said she had a very rare form where she's never understands that there's something wrong with her.
Wow.
And they put her on all these medicines. And they worked her the last 2 years of her life. She was just the good mother the whole time.
Wow.
And I would talk to her on the phone and have a great conversation with her. And I would hang up and I would literally be stunned for 5 minutes after each phone call in total. I just couldn't believe. And, you know, when she passed away, I felt like, it was a miracle that I was able to have end things on a very positive note.
Mm.
That was something I never saw that coming.
Wow.
Yeah. That I did not see that coming.
So did you live with her through college when you went to college? Did you
stay at home? Cause I commuted to Newark. I drove down to Rutgers in Newark every day. And then I commuted to law school 3 years and I didn't want to go to law school. She was like, you're going to law school. And I was like, okay. And, you know, she like filled out the applications and she got me into some good schools. And she was a pretty great mom. She got me into law school.
Yeah.
I never wanted to be a lawyer. And then I was like in law school. And then I didn't know I could quit. Like I always wanted, ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to do something with comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time I was like, oh, I'd love to try stand-up comedy. And I'm like, well, I'm in law school. Like, I don't know. I didn't know I could quit. So I went through law school and then I was.
And became a lawyer.
I was a trial lawyer in Manhattan for 3 years. Yeah. So I that's when I finally moved out. Cause you know, but yes, I lived home with her for 7 years of college.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when, what kind of lawyer, you were a trial lawyer for what?
Oh, the worst kind for an insurance company.
Oh, but, so like you were the one trying to find out when people hurt themselves and sued somebody, you were the one that said, like, you faker.
Right.
Yeah.
And the good thing about it was, if my client, whoever I was representing, was guilty of hurting someone, I could just settle the case and get, like, money. And so the only cases I ever truly defended were ones where they were fake, and there were a lot of fake ones.
Oh, I see.
And I didn't know that. I was 25. I was very young and naive, and about people lying. And I learned the plaintiff lawyers don't get paid unless they make money.
Yeah.
They get a third. If they don't make any money, they don't get anything. So they are very motivated. I mean, we found out, like, some lawyers would use old x-rays from
other people.
And witness, they'd hire witnesses to say they saw an accident. There's one lawyer who finally got caught. He was getting millions of dollars from the city because someone finally figured out that it was the same witness in all these different trials. And even then they couldn't prove it till they found out that one day he said he saw an accident. He was in Rikers Island in jail. And that's the level of proof you need to take down some of these lawyers. I mean, they're unbelievable.
Wow.
Oh, they're unbelievable. Yeah. But, go ahead.
What makes you finally go, like, enough is enough, I got to go do some comedy?
Oh, the second I moved into the city, I was doing, like, trials during the day, and I started doing stand-up at night.
You had written material? Had you been writing material?
Or, I started writing stuff, and then I found this, small club called Good Times that, like, it was kind of easy to get on stage there, and so I just started going there, and then eventually I got into, like, the comic strip and Catch a Rising Star, and then I had no money saved. I had zero money, and I just quit the law job. And when I was making like $50 a week doing stand up, my rent was really low. I was like, okay, this is it. So I just quit. And I remember the last trial I did, somehow the jury found out I was doing stand up and they came to the comedy club after the trial.
The jury did?
Yeah, the jury
did. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It was a very good last trial because the judge, like, I used to make a lot of jokes in court, and the judge in that case was like, he goes, I have a feeling you're not long for the law profession. I feel like you're headed in it. And I was like, wow, that's nice of the judge to say. Because the previous trial I did in federal court, the judge, I made like a joke to the jury, and he called me up and said he was going to fine me in contempt if I made one more joke to the jury. And I was like, well, what's the point of this job?
Yeah. If you can't make jokes.
If you can't joke with the jury.
Yeah.
But so I just quit. And then I was doing stand-up. I did that for 9 years before I started working at Conan.
Wow.
So that was like
was
a whole
that
second.
Long? Wow.
Yeah. Like from 86 to 95.
Wow.
Yeah, in New York City mostly, but I traveled a lot too doing stand-up. I loved it.
Because the first time I met you was in a very early remote bit that we did on this with Doug Llewellyn, who was the reporter from the People's Court.
Right.
And then it was all new to me anyway. I mean, it was all new to everybody, but it was just like, oh, there's this guy here who's a comedian. And I think it had been your idea. Is that why?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had done a submission, and Robert Smigel, who is really great to me, he said, look, we already have all the writers, but we like this one idea with Doug Llewellyn, where he would stand outside the courthouse downtown Manhattan and ask people, because he had just left the People's Court. So now we had him asking people coming out of the courthouse, like, how do you think it went? Like the same thing he did on the People's Court.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pretty simple idea. But so that you guys shot that remote before late night
hadn't even started.
Yeah. In August. And Smigel was very nice. He invited me down to watch, and I was terrified to show up. And I remember meeting you, I'll never forget, because I met Conan and he's all high energy. He's like, hey, thanks, you know, blah, 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 blah. I was like, oh, he seems so, like a nice guy. And then I met Jeff Ross, the producer. He's like, hey, you know. And then and then they're like, oh, and this is Andy. And you were on a bench just reading a newspaper. And you kind of looked up like, yeah, who the fuck are you? And I was like, oh, my God, who is this guy? You were so self-possessed. And I was very impressed by you right away.
Oh, gosh, thanks. It sounds like I was a dick, but
no, you weren't a dick. You weren't a dick. I was like, that guy seems really cool. Not a dick. That came later when you moved to LA. Did sitcom.
Well, come on, just, you gotta.
Just very comfortable in your own skin.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that guy's impressive.
And, I mainly just wasn't sure what was going on, and it was a good article in the paper, and I wasn't sure why I was there, and you know.
Have you talked a lot about how you became the sidekick? Because you were hired to be one of the writers.
And yes. I had mentioned it. I've mentioned it before. I was hired.
All right.
Just on the conversation, because I was hired because I had met Robert Smigel through a friend when I was living in L.A. and we hit it off. And then he reached out to me and was like, hey, I'm going to. And I was the same thing. I was back in L.A. and because I had gotten the job on the movie Cabin Boy.
Right.
And I just got a message from Robert. Hey, I'm working with this guy, Conan O'Brien. And I had just I sat. Jeff Garland invited me to a pilot taping that he did. And it was like some sitcom where he played a cop or something. I don't even remember. Right. But Kate Flannery, who's an old friend of mine, and I went and we sat in the audience and we were sitting in front of Bob Odenkirk and Carol Leifer. And I knew Bob kinda, but I sat and just eavesdropped on them talk about Bob's friend Conan getting the late night job, you know?
Right.
And and probably a little bit of, I'm sure there was a component of Bob being like, why isn't it me? because there was a lot of that. It's the same thing that you say about the stand-ups.
Right.
I think everyone of between the ages of 21 and 37 who had ever made anyone laugh was like, how come him? Why not me?
That should be me.
Yeah, yeah.
Now everyone's that way now with Odenkirk, but instead it's about being an action movie.
Yeah, hero. An action hero or an Oscar winner or whatever.
Right, right.
Or in Little Women. Like, why wasn't I in Little Women?
Oh my God. One of my favorite entrances of all time.
Hello, my little women or something. but anyway, I was hired. I was the first writer hired, and there was with the notion that I'd be doing some performing, and then it just evolved into, I think it was Robert's idea. It just evolved into like Robert saying, when there were camera tests, go sit next to Conan and keep him company and talk to him. And then I just would talk to him. And also too, we had worked up Conan and I had worked up an act around around the halls too.
Like how much time when you say you worked up an act, how long had you guys been in the hallways working on stuff before the tests?
Probably three months. Okay. Yeah.
So you already had this kind of a good rapport of
definitely
him burning hot and you.
Yes. Well, and also too, you know, like there was a, you know, he's an excellent guitar player and he practices all the time. You and I know this.
Yes.
And he's much better now, but like in those days, especially when he would be learning a riff, everyone on the show would have to hear him learn how to play.
Right.
You know, I don't know, you know, Return to Sender or whatever, you know, or some old
rockabilly song. He'd ask your permission first.
Oh, no, no, no. He would just practice the same riff, you know, but he used to do this to people. And it's just now that you know him, it's just part of his like completely weird silliness and his and sort of like having a child that needs Adderall, kind of that.
Right, right, right.
But he would just come up to people like and start playing guitar and singing.
He did that to me.
Yeah, and singing at them. And everyone was like, what do I do? What do I do? This is my boss. What do I do? And but you had that same thing.
No, the same thing. I could keep going. I was freaking out. Like, I thought it was a test. And I was supposed to, am I supposed to dance? What do I was freaking out.
I mean, there were a couple times where I was just kind of like, oh, okay, he's just going to stand here and sing to me like he's a, like it's an Italian restaurant and he's a strolling violinist. But what I started to do when he would do it is I would get up and like, yo, woo, like clap and dance like it was a hoedown. And then it was just kind of, it was like, whereas everyone else kind of just stood there and stared at him, but I was just kind of like, oh, come on.
You leaned into it.
Yeah. It's like this. I mean, it's like when you know somebody's funny and they're doing something that you're sort of, you know, like I didn't feel like, oh, I got to treat him like the boss.
Right.
You know, because I instantly felt like, oh, no, he's just like me. You know, he's a guy cut from the same cloth as me. So I would want somebody to say, what the fuck are you doing? You know,
I want someone to try to help me.
Yeah. And then that just kind of evolved into my job, basically, which is to go like, shut up, sit down, you know, when no one else will do it. But at that time, Robert was the head writer and then he left and Marsh was the head writer because they,
Marsh McCall, right?
Yeah, there was, I don't know if it's, but and then Marsh was there for a short while, and then Jonathan Groff was there for a long time.
Yep.
Were you hired when Jonathan was there?
He and I started the same day.
Oh wow!
And 9 months later, he was a head writer. I was like, oh, I guess I'm a little slow on the uptake here. he just bam, blew past everyone and became the head writer, and he was great.
He was, but I mean, but you guys both have, you have what I think is the two most important things generally in to do that job, which is like, first of all, a good sense of humor, like good taste. And the secondly is your people, you know, like, you know how to talk to people.
That is as sadly, I mean, it is. I actually always loved dealing with people and work. It's like problem solving.
Yeah.
You know, I did like that aspect of it. I used to watch, again, I'd watch rehearsals. I'd be in an office with, you know, Michael Gordon and Brian Rich Brian and Brian Kiley. And I'd watch rehearsal and I'd see Groff holding down the fort next to Conan with you. And I was just like, I'd say it every day that I can't think of a worse job than being head writer.
Yeah.
And, but then when they offered to me, I was like, you know, you feel like, well, you have to, I don't know. I feel like I had to say yes. So, you know, it's just like, then it was trial by fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big learning curve, but it's just when things aren't going well in rehearsal, it's brutal.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing? It's a weird job. It's also kind of like, I mean, and it's been, I mean, aside from trial lawyer, it's been your professional life.
Yeah, no, I, you know, what I'm saying,
and is that okay? Like, are you okay that you didn't become like a big star stand-up comedian or that you didn't, you know?
Yeah, you know what? It's like, I love doing stand-up. But the second I started working on the Conan show, I also really loved shooting things and editing things. And I really enjoyed writing. I really found it fulfilling to hear you or Conan doing jokes that I wrote. Like that was, and having the audience laugh.
Yeah.
I never thought of it as being a TV show. I thought of it as we're putting on this show for this group of 200 people every day.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is a great way to think about it.
Yeah, no, I never watched, you know, I wouldn't go home and watch. That was the experience to me.
Yeah.
When we were taping it. And no, I found it incredibly rewarding. Yeah. I never, I had very, like, I know so many comics that I worked with who had very, they're like, I'm going to have my own sitcom. I'm going to have this. They had a very strong sense. And I like doing comedy, and, you know, it was going well, but I never had defined goals. So, you know, I got hired to do the warm up on Conan, and then that led to the writing job. And I just, once I started doing the writing gig, I really loved it. And I love being head writer. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like, I mean, it was really fun. I mean, really fun. It's been,
yeah, amazing. It's fun to be in charge of that. Yeah. But yeah. Also too, but I mean, but it's also difficult. I mean, it's also like Conan, I love Conan. Conan is like family, but there are days, you know, he's high strung and it's hard sometimes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and how did you cope with sort of just the, and also too, there's just, you get sick of people, you know, sure. You just get, when you're, yes, in proximity, working on that show is really like being trapped with someone working in a show, yeah, like this. 'Cause you're there for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, how would you deal with those kind of moments when you like, just get sick of each other? I mean, 'cause Bob and I deal with it with each other. We have to talk, we've talked about,
right,
it, you know?
Right. But I think I love, just, I've always loved everyone. You know what, for me, I like having been a lawyer and done all this other stuff, just being around other, you know, that term, like, you know, meet your own, no, hang out with your own people. I think just being around funny people every day was such a joy to me that I never got sick of anyone. I always felt like the luckiest person on the planet to,
yeah,
be around really, really funny people and laughing all day. And so, yeah, things would get tense and stuff, but you know what? Yeah. Like sometimes Conan would be in a bad mood during a rehearsal, and I'd always think, oh, I let him down. I'm letting down the show. And then sometimes later I'd find, oh, you know what? He had just done the prep for the interview that night, and he wasn't excited about the guest, or the guest didn't have good ideas for their segment, and he carried that mood into rehearsal, and he'd go,
yeah, or just there's other things going on in his life,
but you know how you don't think that way, right, at the time. You're just like, oh God, what have I done?
Yeah. Yeah.
And believe me, there are tons of times it was definitely me. It was my fault, but I was excited to find out, you know, sometimes, you know, there were other things pushing Conan's buttons. 'Cause it's crazy, all the stuff he has to keep track in his mind for a show every night. You know, there's, yeah, the interview, which, you know, everyone else deals with their own little silo, and he has to kind of deal with everything, which, you know, is a big burden. So,
yeah. If
we'd have arguments, I always treated it kind of like a marriage. Like I'd never want to go to bed angry. And so if we ever had a beef or anything, he and I were really good at just talking it out and resolving it. 'Cause it was never, it was always super minor.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But
it is not, weird.
Nothing real.
It is weird that he insisted that he sleep with you. And I know it was, yes, weird. It was weird.
And
for
you,
your
know
wife,
what? He's
for many
so
years.
Different in bed than he relaxes.
Yeah.
And I'm the more high energy guy, and he kind of just folds into
me. He rolls with it. Oh, it's nice.
Yeah, yeah. They're beautiful spooners.
Are there, are there moments or bits or things that you look back on with like more pride than you do of other things? Like what are your proudest things that you can think of that you did?
Well, you know what? I liked when I was a writer, because the great thing about that show is if you wrote something, you produced it and you know, you were responsible for creating it a bit from soup to nuts. So you really would feel ownership. Mm-hmm. And I you know, there are a lot of different things I did that, yes, I was proud of, and they did well. And you know, you know, the other writers liked it. That's all you really cared about. Like, yeah, if the other writers knew and Conan liked something, I didn't even care if you guys like something in rehearsal, I didn't even care if it didn't do well. Yeah, well, you do care. You do care. You want the audience to like it too, because then, you know. But that was the hard thing about being the head writer too, was that, like, you know, like you'd add little bits to pieces on the show, but you never had that sense of ownership. You know, it was more kind of helping out piecemeal. So, I was really proud of the head writer work, but it's funny. It's different than like, oh, look what I wrote and made and
your individual bits.
Yeah. Like I did a thing a year ago. Like now I'm doing stuff like that again.
Yeah.
Like I made fun of, what was that movie? I can't even remember. The Irishman. I did a parody of that. So, you know, and I was really proud of that when it was done, because I felt like I did the whole thing myself. So.
And the bits that you do now are kind of more produced than most bits are, because you end up getting to have a little bit more time with them.
Yeah. That's true. And I always, like for one of the trout, like in Ghana, Conan was talking, you know, the artist who did in Ghana, we talked to that artist who made a poster for the show, and it was a crazy poster, a Ghanaian movie poster with you shooting a gun and, you know, Conan's Eisenhower mug with dripping blood and all sorts of
pterodactyl or something.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, like as we were shooting it, I was like, oh, Conan said, you know what, we're going to make this into a movie, to the guy. And the second he said that, I was like, oh, we'll make a trailer for this.
Yeah.
And I just started grinding on that and that, you know, and then I love shooting and editing stuff. I kind of like that more than live sketches in a way, just because you can add so many more little tiny details and,
you know, and there's a lot more control too. You get a lot more control than if you write something for him and me to butcher.
Right. I remember you and I did an early remote together. And this was typical of our late night experience. It was the Elephants, the Parade of the Elephants. Remember that? The Elephants, I think the train car that they came in was too big to go under the East River through the train tunnels. So they'd get out in Queens, and then at midnight, they would make a big deal and walk them into Manhattan and over to Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
And you went to cover it. It was one of the first remotes I did. And I just remember we came out, the Elephants came out of the Midtown Tunnel. You were making some quips about the Elephants. And then the Elephants just took off and started heading to Madison Square Garden. We're like, come on, let's go. And our cameraman's like, I can't run. I just had two knee operations a month ago. And we're just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I just love when things go wrong.
Yeah. Like well, I think we ended up just like using footage of the Elephants. And then I stepped in front of a green screen.
Exactly.
And was like, hey, pretending. We found out our cameraman had knee surgery, so we couldn't do this part. So this is fake. Yeah. Yeah. But that was a weird one. The thing I really pull from that, remembering that one, I think they do it for fun. I think that they just get all the elephants off. It's Ringling Brothers.
Yeah.
They walk them through, is it the Lincoln Tunnel that's on that side?
The Midtown Tunnel.
Midtown Tunnel. They walk them through the Midtown Tunnel. And so there's a bunch of people standing at the entrance to the Midtown Tunnel with about probably a quarter of a mile between us and the actual mouth of the tunnel from where you can stand. And you see the elephants come out, and they're out in single file. And then when they come to the tunnel, they line them up, and then they give them a command, which they must have this, be able to do this on command.
Right.
And every single elephant shits and pisses simultaneously. And so there's all these people standing there waiting, and maybe some of them knew it was going to happen, and they get the elephants all lined up, and you think there's going to be some presentational thing, and it's just like, kaboom. And the wave of stench that hit people, I don't know if we had it on camera, but it was just like, whoa, like just a wall of elephant shit and piss stink.
Yeah, no, I remember. I think we shot it.
Yeah.
I don't know if we shot anyone's reaction to it. I think we were too the cameraman was
too shocked.
Yeah. Too entranced. Also, he wasn't able to turn.
Right, right.
My hips don't work either. I can't pivot. Okay, yeah. Great.
Well, we're now on kind of a weird, and we've been in this area a little bit before, kind of before, like, where is the show going? What's the show going to be?
Right.
And there isn't really an answer to that, as far as I know, because I don't even think we know there's going to be a show on HBO Max.
Right.
And the TBS show will end in June. But beyond that, we don't really know. We know it's going to be smaller. But we don't know what exactly the show is going to be like. And
I by smaller, I mean, I think there'll be less. I assume there'll be less episodes than
it'll be weekly.
He's doing now.
It'll be weekly.
Right.
Exactly. It'll be once a week. Yes. Yeah. So it'll be. But I mean, I just don't. Well, it's smaller just in terms of the volume of product.
You know, exactly.
That's one thing.
Right.
But I also don't think, I mean, I just, you know, it's as time has gone on, as I think Conan said in an interview once where somebody said something, I think it was in the New York Times, maybe Dave Itzkoff or somebody, but he said, so was your plan to just, and this was before too, this was years ago, he did this interview. Yeah. He said, like, so is your plan to just kind of have the show get smaller and smaller till it just gradually disappears? And Conan was kind of like, well, yeah, actually, that's a great idea. Yeah, that's sort of probably what it's going to be and I don't, you know, because there's nothing to prove really. And we've been doing this forever and he likes doing it. That's why he's still doing it, because
he likes doing it. Cause he's doing the podcast every week.
Yeah.
And, I remember when we started the podcast, I was like, oh, is he just gonna, cause podcast is hilarious. And it seems like it's just an easier lift in terms of doing it. And, but no, he loves being on TV and he loves television.
Yeah. So. Well, how do you, I mean, what is your game plan? Like, are you just kind of staying in a kind of a reactive mode to what happens?
Yeah. This past year, especially not being involved in, like, I'm on the Zoom meetings with the other writers, which has been like a lifesaver for me just because it's a daily dose of laughs
and human contact.
And it's like the greatest team. I mean, I just love everyone.
Yeah.
And so we're just laughing for the whole meeting. And then, but I'm not involved in, like, you know, Matt, well, you know, you're there at Largo and it's like, what, seven people doing the whole show?
Yeah. I think nine. I think it's like the basic. And then two of those people are house people, you know, are like people that work at Largo, like Flanagan and Michael, who's the house guy. So,
right.
You know, it's three cameras, one sound, one prompter, one makeup.
A makeup
that's
person?
It. Yeah.
And
then me and
then Matt O'Brien.
Me and Matt O'Brien writer, and Jeff Ross.
And Jeff Ross.
And Sona.
And you. Yeah. I mean, is that like a lifesaver for you? Just in this time, just going, okay.
It was.
Thank God.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was so weird when it started out and we were doing, I honestly felt like, well, first of all, I felt like I was retired because
I was
in my house with my dog. And it wasn't like, and I kind of, you know, and like, I couldn't go a lot of places, which is like a lot of retired people. They have a limited income, so they can't go a lot of places. So I kind of felt like this must be what it's like to be retired. But then I was getting, you know, I'd get an email.
Or dead.
I'd get an email and it'd be like, here's this bit, you know, like it's a bit about, you using up the liquor in your liquor cabinet to make cocktails.
Right.
And they'd send it to me. I'd rewrite. I actually, in a couple instances, would like go to the store and buy props.
Right.
I'd film it on my phone or on my computer. I'd just like set my computer, my laptop up, like facing wherever I was shooting. I'd shoot the bit. It would take me 20 minutes. I'd send it back. And then I'd be like, okay, just wait for another email in 2 days right. when I get the bit. And then I'd sometimes do Zoom things with him. But when he started at Largo, and then after a while, there was a day, because I wasn't coming in every day. I was coming in every once in a while. And there was right. like somebody told me that there was a day where he's like, why isn't Andy in here every day? It's more fun when he's here. And I'm like, well, just, you know, and then I immediately just getting texts, change of plan. You got to come in every day. Like, yay. All yay. Right. Oh, my God. It was such a like turning point for me yeah. in this whole pandemic thing, because I got to go out of the house. And even yes. though it's a really short, like there are days when my actual work takes 20 minutes.
Wow.
You know, just like this, yeah. we'll get there and yes. he's recorded somebody and the bit that we do is just real quick or
right.
or it's just us talking. And yeah. then it's like, okay,
that's it.
Let's have some lunch and go home. Yeah.
It's weird.
It's very weird, but it's fun.
It was always so labor intensive. And yeah. now, oh, no. And just being able to go, okay.
Yep.
Tomorrow I'm back in the soup at Largo.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I got to be at Largo by 11:30
right.
a.m.
Right.
And then no, done by 12:40.
And it's you two are, you know, always hilarious together. So it's
well, great. It's, I mean, I think that he's probably in this, you know, he probably sees more people than I do or just has more contact with people. And he's doing the interviews and the podcast.
Right.
But all but, over. Yeah. Zoom. But we both, I think, are both just happy to.
Like yes.
happy to be
it comes across. It really comes across.
Good, good.
You're both kind of like pigs and shit. Like, oh my God, we're in the same, I'm in the same room with another person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though he's 40 feet away from
yeah.
me. Yeah. No, that's great.
Do you have yeah. any, do you have any future sort of outside, like, is there a screenplay you want to write? Does your, no, you know, your wife is a very successful author. She's, Cynthia Dupree Sweeney. And
yes,
and
she just wrote her second book.
And
coming out April 6th.
Do you get
good company?
Does that give you any envy? Do you have like author envy?
I'm so excited and happy for her. Cause
yeah.
I again, in terms of being lucky, I realized being, you know, a selfish asshole, like now I understand that for years she was like basically raising our two kids while I was at work every night. Like, you know, we were there till like midnight. Every
it
night.
Could be a very consuming job. Yeah.
Yes. And she was very selfless about it and really generous. And so when she wrote her, when we moved to LA, she went back to school and got her MFA in fiction writing. And then for her senior thesis, her professor said, you know what? I think this could be a novel. It started out as a short story. And she just said, okay. And she just kept writing and writing. And after 2 years, it was a novel. And she sold it. And then she was going on book tours. And I got to go on book tour with her.
Oh, because, wow.
I mean, that's another reason I stopped being the head writer, because this book was coming out and I thought, oh, it would be really nice for me now to kind of be her wingman or support her in any way I can. And so for me, it's been great. I've loved it. And I've loved being, I feel like I'm giving back a bit. All the support she gave me, I'm trying to give it back to her.
That's good.
Yeah.
But do you have any outs? Like, is there a screenplay you're dying to write?
No, we talked, if someone comes and tells me, I have to write a screenplay. I will write a screenplay. I'm serious. Someone give me an assignment and I'll do
right,
it.
Right, right.
Yeah. And, you know, supposedly, I again, it's show business and I never believe anything till it happens. But, you know, there are going to be more travel shows. So,
yeah,
in the future. But, you know, I mean, with the world the way it is and COVID and now there's a new, you know, new evolving COVID strains. I mean, I do feel very reactive. I feel like everything is still very uncertain to me. I can't imagine things getting back to normal anytime soon.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know what's next. I really
That's probably somebody wanting you to write a screenplay.
That would be great.
You better pick it up.
Tell me right now what to write a screenplay about. I'll do it.
Well, is there anything you do differently Is there anything looking back, you know, that like you've learned from? I mean, maybe move out a little earlier from your mom's house.
Stay a trial lawyer. Yeah. yes. Oh my God. Yeah. I was the angriest. I was such an angry dick in my 20s at myself.
Yeah.
For like, just because I didn't start my comedy career till I was like 29.
Yeah.
And I was like, what have I been doing?
Yeah.
You know, and I thought it was way too late to get any traction or do it. So yes, I'd move out a little earlier.
Yeah.
And, yeah, but no, other than that,
but would you say that slow move gave you some perspective that you wouldn't have otherwise?
Yes.
Because you certainly have a lot more of a sort of wide meta view of the world, and you are more accepting of the world than a lot of people I know, you know, and especially a lot of comedy people.
Right.
And I think that, you know, having lived through what you lived through, probably.
It's all kind of gravy to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In a way. So, wait a minute. What was the question? No, you know what? I just feel like I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've worked very hard. I work hard, very hard, but also just very, you know, lucky.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, you know what? I used to have a lot of regrets about choices I didn't make and made. And that kind of melts away as you get older.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, well, like I now the fact as a trial lawyer kind of cracks me up. It was like a weird little side project for 6 years. But no, it's true. I think the older you are, when things start to take off, the more even keeled you are about it.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I also, yeah. And it just, a friend of mine in Chicago, she lived in this weird little sort of guest house behind a house. And it was really strange. I don't know what it had been, but it was two stories. Yeah. It was like this little sort of cracker box house. And it was right next to the L in sort of a weird confluence of alleys.
Uh-huh.
And she had a dog that was a stray that she'd gotten on the street.
Uh-huh.
And I was over at her house one day, and she left the gate open. And there was like you could see a straight shot down the alley for just blocks and blocks and blocks.
Yeah.
And the dog took off through the gate. Yeah. And it got outside the gate, and she went, "Hey!" And it stopped and looked at the alley and looked back at her and looked back at the alley, and then like slowly trotted back. it was kind of like, okay, I know what that's like. And I know what back there is like. I think I'm going to stay back there. And I think that's like, I think about that as being, there are people who have been in the alley. Like they know. And I mean, and in varying degrees, they've been in the alley, you know. But there's been hardship or, you know, like no glamour and dirt and filth. And you're like, hey, what are you bitching about? This is nice, you know.
Right.
I mean, granted, I'm a world-class bitch, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just it's just the steam I produce when my engine is going.
I'm happy to be a house dog.
yeah. I mean, you know, I think that people that undergo some kind of hardship, at least especially with like in the silly ice cream candy mountain world of show business,
right,
that they experience some real life, that they are usually the ones that aren't complaining that they've been in their trailer for 3 hours. You know, they're the ones that are like, I get my own fucking trailer. Like I get my own toilet. What? You know, like, all right. You know,
Don't shit in it. Only pee.
I know. No. And a trailer, you can shit in a trailer. You can't shit in a tour bus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's folks out there.
See, just I'm always learning stuff.
No, that's a trailer you can shit in. You can shit in a trailer. Okay. Yeah. The the Teamsters come and a guy comes and pumps it out.
Oh, that's okay, fine. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Those guys really complain. They have to clean it out.
Yeah, they do. Well, Mike, thank you for coming. I mean, it's kind of weird having you on just because I know you so well, but I've had this before, you know, with other friends, and it is
right.
It's almost like a license to pry a little bit more than I would
if
you and I were just talking.
Right.
But I appreciate your time and for your frankness, and I love you very much. And you know,
I love you.
You certainly have made my life better in innumerable ways, and I'm now very appreciative of that. No, I'm not. I'm not. Seriously.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say.
You know, at work.
Right.
I don't mean, you have a nice house and you're a good cook. So I mean that, you know,
my wife's a good cook.
You're a good cook too. So.
You are an amazing cook.
Well, thank you.
We don't have time to get into that.
Took you long enough.
I'm sure oh my God, no one slow roasts pork like you do.
Hear that, ladies?
you're an amazing cook.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I like
it. And you take pride in it too.
I do.
You love it. It's, you know what else? You are an amazing, you're incredibly mechanically inclined. I don't know if people know that about Andy Richter.
Put things together. I know how.
But I learned so much at work just from watching you, because you're great. Part of that is like problem solving, and you're like, you look at something and you know how to fix it. Like you literally on the floor, you would like if a prop was broken or something, and you mentioned Teamsters, you're not allowed to touch it.
Yeah.
So, but I'd see you just go, the ballast is in the wrong place. If you move and they'd be like, oh yeah. It's like, that's very impressive. But the same thing with comedy. Like, you know, if something wasn't working, you just kind of have a great mind for fixing it. It's probably the wrong thing to bring up at the very end of this podcast.
No, it's not, I'll take it whenever I can get it.
Okay.
I like the way things go together and they all are kind of connected, you know, whether cooking a meal is putting something together, and writing a comedy bit is putting something together, and you know, managing a relationship is putting something together. It's all, you know, everything can be structural if you look at it that way. And then I find it helpful to make the best of things by looking at them structurally, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's been a pleasure being your friend all these years.
Yes.
To work with you.
Why? What are you dumping me?
Yeah. Oh. Moving on. I'm getting back into bed with Conan.
All right. Well, I hope to see you again someday.
Oh, yeah. Where are you?
Nice.
In Burbank?
I'm in Burbank.
I'll swing by.
All right.
We can distance.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure, Mike. And thank you all out there for listening. I'll be back next week with more blabbity blab. I've got a big, big
love for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It's produced by me, Kevin Bartelt, executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Chris Bannon and Colin Anderson at Earwolf. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, associate produced by Jen Samples and Galitza Hayek, and engineered by Will Beckton. And if you haven't already, make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.